football on Off the Ball.
They can no longer dominate the ball, and the fear factor from City is gone, but they'll still finish second or third.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
You are welcome back to Wednesday night's Off the Ball. Now, the piece you're about to hear is around the Oslo 2025 Homeless World Cup. We're going to have Scott O'Brien and Emma Brennan in studio with us to talk about participating in this competition in August. Before that, I'm delighted to say that Sarah Joyce, Head of Fundraising and Communications with Coolmine, is with me in studio. Sarah, good evening to you. How are you doing?
Hi, Owen. How's it going?
Very well. So you might just set the scene on this conversation for us with regards to the work that Coolmine does and how it integrates with sport and the Homeless World Cup.
Yeah, so you're going to hear from Emma and Scott. So for the Homeless World Cup, we had two, we called them graduates, so they're clients that went through our program. Scott and Dara from Coolmine Lodge were on the men's Irish team for the Homeless World Cup, and then four women from Ashley House, which is our women's residential services, represented Ireland on the women's World Cup. So Coolmine Therapeutic Community is a, for our residentials, it's a therapeutic community, which means basically that people of lived experience share their lived experience with other people within the community, and they become like a family for their residential periods, which is like minimum 6 months, and they learn from each other.
Okay.
Of their lived experience. So it becomes a really safe space because the people that are supporting you and talking to you know what you've been through and can empathize with what you've been through and can support you, where people from the outside world just may not understand it in the same world. So that is essentially what a therapeutic community is. As I say, they live as a family. So everything in the community, the cleaning, the cooking, the outside area, the inside area, every single thing is run by the community themselves. And Ashley House is the only women and children's therapeutic community in the country, which means that women, where mothers with children up to the age of 5 can bring their children with them to residential care, because one of the biggest fears for women is that they'll be separated from their children and their children may go into the care system, and that breaks the bonds of love and trust that, you know, for those families. So that's what a therapeutic community is. So when you hear the guys talking about really like looking at their feelings and being talking about their emotions and learning about themselves, that's what they're talking about. So we have that three residentials, two of them are in Dublin, and then we have 14 day services as well. So not everybody needs to go to residential programs, but they may need help in sport. So we would have, in Dublin alone, we have four different services, and then we're in Cork and Kerry and Limerick as well.
Okay, amazing. Sober October is coming up. Talk to us about this.
Yes. So hopefully Emma and Scott will inspire you as well to support Coolmine. A lot of people might not know what Coolmine's name, so that's one of the things. So trying to fundraise when people don't know you are can be very difficult. But for those residentials, we have to turn on the lights, we have to keep them warm, we have to keep bed sheets, we have to make sure people are fed. So that's what the money is going to. Sober October is aimed at social drinkers who may want to take a break for October and just feel healthy and happy and, like, you know, do alternative things with their time for October. So if people are interested in signing up, it's just soberoctober.ie and just follow the steps. And we'd love to see if you would want to get involved. And just on the sports side of things, do you know, some of the money that we raise as well is going to those people have to find alternative use for their time when they're not in addiction. So things like sport. So whether it be music therapy, sport, like football clubs, going to the gym, all of those activities cost money, but they're vital in order for people to find alternative lifestyles once they come out of addiction. So that's hugely important. So soberoctober.ie, please sign up and get involved.
Yeah, and I think there's probably a lesson there for everybody. Anybody who does want to engage in Sober October, no matter how dependent you are on alcohol or not, I mean, finding those alternative pursuits is definitely a conversation that should be having at every aspect of our communities. Sarah, thank you very much for that. Now, earlier on, I did speak to Scott O'Brien and Emma Brennan. Just a bit of a trigger warning on this, that there will be conversations around addiction. They're incredibly brave and honest and sharing in their experiences. So it's an absolutely fantastic conversation, but just wanted to give that heads up. So here is Scott and Emma. You're welcome back to Wednesday Nights Off the Ball. Now, in Oslo last month, we had the Homeless World Cup. The men's team and the women's team were both represented there. And two of their players are with us in studio. We have Scott O'Brien here. Hello, Scott.
How are you?
Emma Brennan's here. Hello, Emma.
Hi, how are you?
The women went further than the men is the top line here, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Where did he finish up?
So we came fifth in our tournament thing. Like, there was like strong teams. So we got a plaque. Like, it kind of goes by like 12 downwards. Like, so
yeah,
we did well.
Right. How did you get on, Scott?
Came 16th, you know, it wasn't ideal, but typical Irish team.
Yeah.
Look, we've done very well. I thought, like, for the teams that we are against, you know, I thought we'd done very well.
What sort of nations were you up against? Was it like football powerhouses?
Uganda.
Right.
Brazil.
Okay.
Egypt.
We were playing Uganda, Italy, Norway themselves, America, and then there was like a mixed team as well. England, they were called a mixed team as well. So yeah, there was a good few, like, but they were strong. Uganda was very strong, I have to say.
How much did you know about the Homeless World Cup before actually going to it?
Well, we were told like to watch videos and that, but I never really thought it was like this big thing until I started playing and training in St. Catharines. So
right.
It was massive, like.
Scott, what about yourself?
Yeah, we genuinely had an embrace, you know. We didn't think it was the way you play 11-a-side football. Like, even then when we came back, I'm playing 11-a-side football now. And it's like, I'm looking at the ball and I'm like, no one can get the ball off me. Like, it's weird how it was ran. But then it shows you that you control the game, you know. And it's such a weird feeling. Everyone does be, I don't know, all over the shop with it. I think that when you get your first two games there, it all comes to you straight away then. Like, I don't think the boys' team anyway struggled with the rules. It was bet into our brain, like, before we went over, not what to do.
Right, like what? What were you told?
Not allowed to cross the line. Like, three people are not allowed in their own half.
Okay.
So one of us always had to make sure that if we're defending, one of us had to stay and do the half. And then what we should do, we're not allowed in the box. You give away a penal. Even the penals were crazy. Like, you have to roll the ball and it's not allowed to stop. So when you roll the ball, you have to, like, shoot straight away.
Okay.
So...
Right, so, and who, the referee rolls the ball to you?
We roll it from the halfway line towards their goal.
Right.
And then it's just you and the keeper.
Okay, so there's a load of different rules to football here for this World Cup.
Yeah.
Okay, and so, because you're playing in, it's not indoor, but it's like in the sort of cage football, is it?
FIFA Street.
FIFA Street, that's exactly the best way of putting it, yeah. It's fascinating. Did you have many conversations with players from other teams?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Like, they... Irish, like, everyone loves the Irish, like, to be honest. Like, the second or third day, like, one of the women from the team, she went up and she went on the DJ decks and she had the place hopping.
Right.
And I mean, everyone from every country was around and they were like, oh, it was madness. Like, everyone was bouncing around the place and Hannah Lagan playing and the whole lot. Yeah. It was really, really good. Like, you know, everyone just loves the Irish.
Yes.
You know, and air trainers, like, they love... Air trainer knows everyone from every country, so people were coming up left, right and centre to him as well, which was lovely to see, like, all the other coaches and that.
Was this the first time in your lives that you've represented Ireland in something?
It was my first time, yeah.
Mine too, yeah.
How does that feel?
Amazing, you know, emotional. You get really emotional when you think about it. Like, you're not just walking the streets of Ireland when you are, you know, homeless. Now you're walking the streets of Norway representing your country.
Yeah,
it is such an emotional thing, like, being from the streets of Dublin, for me, like, and being able to get a chance to prove that who you are today is not who you were years ago either.
Yeah, like, it's amazing as well, the timeline of all of this. Like, Emma, you were saying that your program in Coolmine finished up the day you went to Oslo, the day before you went to Oslo?
The day before I went to Oslo, yeah.
So how long was that program for?
6.5 months.
Right, so this is, congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
That must be an unbelievable day where these two things are colliding, where you have achieved something incredible that's far more important than any sport,
exactly.
Like, in terms of your own life. And then at the same time, you have something that feels so much more important than everything else as well, which is like representing Ireland.
It was amazing, like, because I have three kids. Like, my eldest, she's 12 now, my middle fella's 7 and my wee fella's 5. And I was like telling Tegan, like, you know, I'm finished now and I'm going to play football. And she didn't realise, you know what I mean, until she said it to her teacher, who's mentally into all sport. And he was like, that's a massive thing for your mum. Like, she was like, she's going to represent Ireland. And Tegan was like, oh my God, like, when she realised that I was doing it, you know, so finishing treatment and then going to play for my country, like, it was just out of this world, I have to say. I still get goosebumps, like, I still, like, get goosebumps thinking about it.
Yes.
I really do. And people notice you. Do you know, they've seen you play and they notice you, like, they know, oh, you played for the straight league, like, yeah.
Yeah. Scott, had you been in Coolman recently before that?
We finished up in January.
Right.
And I graduated, let's see, 2 weeks ago, a week ago.
Okay, right. And congrats.
Yeah, do you know, tough programme, really tough. The age bracket, again, I'm only 20 years of age and to go and get that is good, but then it's just hard, I think, really hard for. But it was hard, very hard for me, but look, I'm past that. I've done it, so now it's just onwards and upwards now. It's just me on my feet. Me, like, I can only fall back on myself now.
Was it a similar timeline as well, six and a half months?
6.5 months, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you take us back to the beginning? I know it's basically two separate stories that we're going to be talking about here today. But Scott, first of all, do you want to take us back to the start of the point in your life where you do end up in Coolmine? Your life up until the point where you start engaging with Coolmine in the first place, when you begin your programme.
Yeah, look, I think I got very lucky with life, you know. We ended up in hospital and I just had a drug out, a paracetamol overdose, and lucky enough that we was already kind of linked in before the hospital incident with pre-entries and all that, but I wasn't giving it me all. I was only like just turning up here and there when I felt like it. And then my key worker from D15 came through the door and told me that if I stay clean in hospital that I'd be able to get into Coolmine. And then I was just kind of like, yeah, right, but I didn't listen to her. I wasn't staying clean for the 2 weeks. I was still using in hospital. And then it was like, the day I was meant to leave, she came up with a urine sample, and I went and diluted it without the water. And then thought, she could look like I passed it on the test. And then she drove me to Coolmine Lodge. And I went in, and they made me do another one there. So I was like, shit. And then I done it. And it came up that cocaine was in my system. And I just got lucky. Can I say his name?
You can, of course. It's totally up to you. Yeah.
Bernard Murray turned around and he told me that, look, he gave me an opportunity with the O-line. That
right.
You take me in.
What do you think he saw on you?
A little bollocks. No. I think he's just seeing what's ahead of me, like my future, you know. He doesn't put his trust in the people that he knows won't. It's a man full of wisdom. And I don't know what he's saying, but so far to work in, and what he's saying is who I am today, I think.
Can you explain the work that Coolmine actually does? Because from what you've said there, that there's obviously a little bit of work that you need to do to get in there in the first place, I guess, because you obviously said you needed to be sober, you needed to have clean urine to get in there. So there's a little bit of outside Coolmine work you need to do before you get inside Coolmine.
Yeah, so like you can go to like daily programs before you attend like the residential treatment. If it's something that's going to help you and stabilise you, like, well then yeah, do it, like, you know, just keeping ahead in the game. Like, it's just they do groups in like pre-entries, they do like little groups, and it's talk about how you feel, what's going on for you, take feedback off people, give feedback off people to people, sorry. And then like you just have to provide clean urine, so you're not to like use or drink just while you're attending them, like. But some people obviously are struggling a lot and do like use and drink. But they're trying. You just have to keep that in the back of your mind that, like, if you're not using and drinking, other people might be. But that can be a trigger for you. So these are all like little hula hoops that you have to like juggle, to be honest with you, jump through. And it's tough, you know, if you're like looking at other people under the influence in the group. How does that make you feel? So, you know, are you going to leave that group and take action, or are you going to go and take the easy way out and pick up again? So, we just, what can we do before is this, you just provide your group and stabilise it, and then you have the choice to stay clean. You have to make that choice.
For you, your own life story, you talk about using cocaine there before going into the fuel mine. Was it everything under the sun up until that point before you realised maybe that you need some help?
I was homeless. Like, I was just in houses where you shouldn't be in houses, no. Just, acting a mate. Just involved in petty crime, taking drugs. Then it just got hit. I didn't care what drug I was taking. Just once I felt free in myself and felt like I used to love, like, how would you say it, the feeling of being psychotic. I used to love that feeling because it wasn't who I was. Like, it was just scary. It's just, yeah.
And when you were homeless, whereabouts were you generally based? Like, you're obviously in the
Park Gacy.
Okay, yeah.
Park Gacy, yeah, you know, just up and down in the Phoenix Park. Then just around town, everywhere around town, you know, who I could mix with, I'd get involved with. Like, people. And people I'd just be a puppet for my fix. So it's like, what could I do for them that'd help me get my next fix? You know? So, not a good way to be as a young fella, because that's how you get roped into everything. And not everyone makes it out of that.
Of course. That's the thing. Like, when we listen to Scott tell his story, and I will jump between the two of them here. How much of that hits home? How many similarities are there in terms of your own story, or is it very individual and very unique?
Would be the same. Like, cocaine would have been my massive drug of choice, like, to be honest. My kids were taken off me 18 months ago, like, and took to my mother's, and I just fell down a big rabbit hole, like. But I was never would think, like, that I had a problem with drink, but I always did. I always fell to drink. I was always into sports, to be honest, and I'd go to sports and I'd always be like, oh, go for a drink or whatever. That's when I was in school and all, but I never would have thought I'd anything, you know. It was a big part of me life, but it was, you know. And then, like, people, like, as my daughter got a little bit older, people saying, I think you have a bit of a problem, mama, like, you know, and I never thought I did, and I went and listened to them and all, and went on to have two other kids, like, and it was just kept coming, like, the drugs and whatever I could get my hands on, to be honest, like. As Scott said as well, like, you know, I loved that adrenaline buzz, like, to feel just out of myself, like, you know, I was confident walking around and felt, oh, sure, who cares, once I like myself, that's all right, like, type thing.
Yeah.
So for me, it was after Christmas, and I was linked in with a place called Tourist in Dundalk, and I was going to them, and she knew on me, like, I'd go into her of a Thursday, every Thursday, and she'd say, how are you today? And I'd be there looking out the window waiting for my session to finish with her. And I'd say, I have to go here, I have to go there, making up these stories to just go and use.
Okay.
Do you know, and after Christmas I went in and I said, I need help. I fell to my knees after Christmas. New Year's Day was the last day I used. And I fell to my knees in front of my mother and I begged her for help. I said, because it's life or death for me, mum. I said, the kids would be walking up past my grave, like, that's how bad it got. And I, like, my daughter, like, they couldn't even look at me, do you know what I mean? I couldn't look at them. I was pure guilty of what I was after doing and all. And I started pre-entries, and my the woman in tour, she said to me, I prayed for you all over Christmas, because I knew, she said, you were going to die. She said that's where it was going for you, like. And I ended up in really bad psychosis over Christmas, but didn't care, like, do you know what I mean? I thought, this is all right, like. And then started my pre-entries and went to my physio on the 5th of February, which is my birthday. Turned 34 and got in then 2 weeks later, and started my programme, like. So, like, it's been going on years, but I never would have picked up. I just picked up on it. I just kept going and going and going. It was to get away from everything. I always needed something to help me get through my life. Daily basis, like, walking around with sunglasses on, even if it wasn't sunny, do you know, that type of way, I didn't care. Shadow of myself, like, but I never would have seen it, like. Mm. Like, still to this day, like, I look back and, you know, if I see a picture of myself, like, and I think, Jesus, scary to look at myself. It was really bad. Like, as I say, I always played sport, and it just always was something there for me, like, even if it was drink or even if it was a sulfadine or something, like, it always had something.
And you were playing sport even throughout
when I was younger, I played soccer, yeah. I played for a team called Key Celtic, yeah.
And then you gave it up for a while?
Gave it up then, yeah. Stopped playing. And then, actually, to be honest, I started playing Gaelic then.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
And then did you manage to keep playing Gaelic the whole way through?
Yeah, or? Not really. Then I picked up boxing. So there was always something.
There's always something.
Yeah, always something.
Is there a point where sport completely leaves your life for a while?
Never.
Never, really?
Never. Like, I always loved sport. Then I went back to Mothers and Others. And now there's a Mothers and Others team of soccer. So when I go home to where I'm from, Dundalk, I'll probably pick that up now. I was asked to play football up here, so I'm thinking of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so always sport was always something, but as I say, I always had a drink after it. Oh, a big reward, like, for training even.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then Coke was introduced into my life, and to be honest, I loved it, like, at the time.
Yeah, was Coke where it ended?
Yeah, Coke was where it ended, yeah.
Just enough of it to make it a significant, like, they just, and what age were your kids when they start saying to you?
They were taken the day after Father's Day, I'll never forget it, and it was going downhill, you know, right. People were saying it to me, like, it was gradually going downhill, and then all of a sudden, bam, they were taken, and just give up. I just said, what's the point? Like, to be honest, I tried to take my life Christmas time, and a knock came at my door, and a young fella came in and stopped me, like, and I was like, why, like, and was taken to hospital, and yeah, it's very, very hard, you know, so.
Yeah. Yeah.
And get a bit emotional talking about it because they don't really talk about it, like, to be honest. I just talked about it in Cool Mind, but yeah, that's where it ended for me, like.
Thank you so much for sharing this, and the same goes for you both. Like, as comfortable as you are sharing your own story today,
I have to say Cool Mind talk a lot. Cool Mind was actually one of the best things I ever did in my life. Like, having three kids obviously was an inspiration in my life too, but doing Cool Mind, it really, really helped me, like. I'm 8 and a half months clean now.
Good stuff.
So.
Yeah, amazing. That gap between going from that point to Cool Mind, as Scott has outlined, there's a bit of work you need to do on yourself before you actually, the doors are open to you. What was that process like for you?
It was one of the hardest programs, to be honest. Like, yeah. It was, like, as people say, you're off the wall. Like, you know, I couldn't say, as they say, a pull-up in there. Like, I couldn't say with a pull-up, don't point me out, don't pull me up. You know, if it was on me, it wasn't on me. And then I kind of gradually fed into it, like, you know. And I've made some good friends in there, like, I did, like, and, you know, it's just been amazing. Like, I really would, I'd like people, like, that's struggling to reach out for help and do Ashley House. And I have to say, Ashley House is one of the only places that take kids in. So you can go in there with your kids. Like, my kids used to come up and stay at me, which was massive. My daughter came up, she stayed a few times, my two boys stayed a few times, and they loved it because the atmosphere is brilliant, you know, everyone, it's like, we're a family, like, you know, there's babies in there, it's from babies from naught up to 5 years, like, and there's a school and everything in it, it's amazing, there's everything in it.
Yeah.
Do you know, and it's the only place in Ireland that does it.
It sounds like it, and then the process of actually getting clean
going in, yeah.
Who helped you with that?
So tourists helped me with that, and then I did my pre-entries in North Edward Street once a week,
right?
So I went there every Monday.
Was that difficult for you?
It was, yeah, it was.
What was the hardest part about that?
Just going up and then leaving the place, and you're thinking, oh God, can I do this, like, do you know,
the doubt almost.
Oh, the doubt that I was going to fail, because I always felt I failed everything in my life. Do you know, it was hard. No self-belief.
In a way, has the last month being over in Oslo last month, does that inject a bit of self-belief? Does that come with it? Or, like, I mean, even without the World Cup last year, do you actually just get that self-belief back and you start to discover that just from being happier in what you're doing day to day anyway?
Yeah, 100% I do. Like, I'm happy to where I am today.
Yeah.
Oslo was a big part of that, to be honest. It brought me to believe in myself, and I can do, if I want to do something, I'll achieve it. My goals, like, you know, I used to set myself up on a big pedestal and always would fail, like, But I think I made myself fail. So now if I want to achieve a goal, I'll go for it. And good things are happening. Doors is opening for me. So it's good.
To what extent, and look, you can only speak for yourself, do you think that people who struggle with addiction, that part of that is down to the self-belief or, you know, self-confidence or maybe questions over who they are? Is that a big thing?
Yeah, it's fear. You run away from your fears. Like, you know, it could be childhood trauma. It could be anything. It could be relationships. It could be anything. Like, you know, for me, it used to be anything. Just anything. If I lost a game, say, or just a lot, like, it would have been trauma for me. Like, you know, I hate fiction. I hate all that kind of thing. I can't do it, like, you know, and I used to just fear it. And I'm an only child.
Right.
So I never had any brothers. I hadn't got brothers or sisters to run to. So if something happened to me, I think in my head, what can I do to get away from this?
Mm.
You know, so for me, that's the way it was for me. Like, I struggled all through my life with talking. I could talk to talk, like, but at the same time, like, I think that was just because I just wanted to be out of myself, do you know? I'd be quiet, but I'd talk.
Yeah.
Just to get away from fears, like.
That's it. And yeah. Nobody will kind of know that there is
nobody
a deeper
everything.
Vulnerability
Never,
there.
Nobody would know anything was ever wrong with me.
Does that ring true to you as well, Scott?
Yeah, I'm just out of days now, though, yeah. Just, you know, when you, like, yeah. Just connect to something, it's like, yeah, that was me, and then you start thinking all that same thing, like, you know, yeah, that was mine, you know. Trauma is such a big thing for me. Like, being a young fella, like, growing up in two separate households, one isn't so stable, and then one is the perfect on the weekends, like, I'm getting out with my dad on the weekend, and everything is cool. Then I go home on the Monday, my master up from the Friday, like, you know, random people in the house, like me, like, what's going on here, like, only a kid, not understanding. But I used to love that as well because I used to be wild about it. I used to just be wild. But that catches up, you know, over years and years, that catches up. And then you see stuff as a kid that you're like, oh, it's cool now. But then it all comes back to you, like.
When you say you're a kid, what age are we talking?
Like, about 9, 10, right. 11, you know.
Like fully aware and you
fully
remember
aware,
all those
yeah,
things.
Yeah, fully aware, you know.
Understanding everything.
Yeah, like. It's crazy, you know. I was the one dressing my sisters to bring them to school because my ma's still up on the session, you know. I'd be manipulated. Like, I'd manipulate myself into not saying anything to my dad only because I didn't want them knowing what was going on with my ma, you know.
Did he suspect anything?
Like, see, this is what I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
So, like, you could have easily put away when I was going down on a Friday how I was dressed, you know. I was dressing myself, like, the age of 9, so, like, come on.
It's one of those things, because obviously it's your life, and you haven't lived anybody else's life at that point, or never will, so you don't actually have the comparison between what's normal and what's abnormal, right?
Yeah, I think my normal is very normal, to someone else is very normal.
Yeah. Especially as a 9-year-old, like, you're just kind of getting on and getting by with whatever's presented to you. At what stage after that, or how many years after that, does the house go, or do you become homeless after that? Because obviously you're living between two homes.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, my dad took me then, you know, at a young age to his house in Clonlogan, and, like, I just started hanging around with the wrong people in school. Started, like, smoking weed, getting involved again in crime, you know, trying to just fit in. That's the word I was looking for, fit in. I wouldn't do anything for anybody, you know, all the cool kids on the block, all the people. Then he just got fed up and he was like, you're going to have to go.
He kicked you out?
Yeah. And, you know, that sat with me well because I fell back on somebody, you know. I was with a girl at the time and couldn't give up, like, I didn't care when I got kicked out. Didn't bother me.
What age were you at that point?
17.
Okay, right. So he's probably looking at you thinking he can fend for himself at this point. He's old enough, sort of thing.
Yeah. And then just fucked me out with 2 black bags. And yeah, I just loved the freedom then, you know. That's when I started picking up coke, picking up weed, picking up smoking. Dropped my football. I dropped everything. And started going out at 17. Selling drugs.
It's amazing that the sport goes at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, it's... you don't want to put too fine a point on it, but like it is, it kind of is a representation almost of unity or some sort of normalcy in life. Look, I know you managed to keep sport going for the whole thing, but
well, not to a certain extent. Like, you know, I was playing Ga and I was playing for County, like I used to play for County Loud, like when I was younger and that, and I stopped that then. Do you know what I mean? I just stopped. I was like, nah, enough's enough type thing. And then, you know, they said, like, yeah, boxing and that, and then fell pregnant with my daughter and that. But, you know, sport was always in me. Like, even if I was only playing outside with the kids, like when they were younger and that, I'd still always play and always loved. Even when I was pregnant with my daughter, I was playing Ga and people were saying, you need to stop playing the Ga and all. But that helped me. Like, that helped my head, because my head was always manic, like, always on the go, on the go, on the go, non-stop, like 24/7, like going to sleep, head manic, do you know?
Yeah.
So I was 21 having Tegan, like, so.
That was your first child?
Yeah. So.
And your own story, like at that point, who were you living with or?
So I was living at home with my mum and dad.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then how long after that do you become homeless?
No, I wasn't homeless. Right. I got my own house then.
Okay.
And that house was just mental. Tegan would be away and the house, I was working in a shop at the time and I'd go down to the pub and sure take people back and party on, party on, party on, like, you know.
And
she'd come back up and I'd be going around cleaning. Like, my mother used to say to me, she only had said to me recently, I had a three-way in Ashley House and she'd say, I used to wonder why you were going around with the spray 24/7 cleaning.
Right. Yeah.
It's no laugh, but at the same time, when I think about it, I must have been off the wall going around the house. Yeah. I didn't think I was, but I was.
And how long did you stay there for?
In the first house, stayed there for nearly 2 years.
Right.
And then moved to another place and then got offered then me half house and got that. And now I've forever home with my three kids.
Nice.
Well, please God, when I get them back, you know, that's a work in progress there.
Scott, can I ask you about that period then in the following few years? Like, I'm often curious about, like, the idea of danger at that point. Like, I know you've obviously gone through a lot over the last couple of years, and maybe it's only the way in which you deliver it that it's very matter of fact. At that point, when you mentioned the two black bags getting thrown out of home, was there ever a sense of danger or a sense of fear at that point for you, or had you managed to compartmentalise that?
Yeah, nah, like, of course there was, but, like, when I moved in then and was sleeping on the couch, old girlfriend's couch, it was just, she got me a job and everything again, you know, with her uncle, and it was sparking, and I was doing all right, and then again, got involved with the wrong group of people in work, started going out with them then, and then things just started evolving and getting found out about me. So, and then when things started, like, coming out, the spanner got thrown in the works of me working and selling drugs and doing drugs, people finding out. I didn't want finding out, obviously, you know, people dislike you for that. So I went and rented a room. So I took a bigger leap.
Right.
I was like, right, now I'm by myself. I was like, I have no one but myself now. But with that, I still didn't stop, you know. I never felt the fear of, I'm going to be homeless, I'm going to be this, I'm going to be that. I was just prioritising getting up and going to work to take drugs that evening. The minute I woke up, I was thinking about that evening, you know. I'd be in work and I'd still be thinking about that evening while I'm still out of it, like.
Yeah.
Crazy.
It's, like, as a 17, 18-year-old at that point, I presume the money you would have made from selling drugs just completely outweighed what you would have made as a...
For sure.
As a...
Yeah, 100%, you know.
And, like, the temptation is right there. I also wonder, to what extent do you believe you were taken advantage of as somebody who maybe, you know, had just gone through a very difficult process of being thrown out of home, and maybe people out there... people who you would have been selling drugs for, just like pariahs, knew that there was a vulnerability in you.
Yeah, that's the way it is, you know. It's like, you know, someone has to speak for young kids today. Like, that's how you get roped in, you know. You're like, if you don't, this is just how it is. If you don't grow up with a stable family, it's like these people come out of nowhere and grab you.
Right.
You know?
It's that simple.
Yeah. All they have to do is show their car, show what phone they have or what clothes they have in their back.
Yeah. Would you go along with that, Emma?
I would. I did have a stable family. Like, I think the thing was for me as well, as Scott said, like, I always wanted to be with the older crowd.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? When I was in first year, I was hanging around with third years, Mitch and fighting, you know, things like that. Like, I always, if someone said something, I'd be like, yeah, do you know, and all up for type thing. And, you know, I always hung around with a bad old crowd in school and, you know, always in trouble. And there was a thing called Day Report. Like, I was on that in first year, up until sixth year, like, I was on that. So I'd have to hand that up to the table and be signed off. And I'd be acting the maggot, like, never played attention, didn't care, you know, because, as I said before, my head was always mental, do you know. And, like, I moved from Dundalk to a country, out to country, and that was one of the biggest mistakes that ever happened to me, because I was always, to be honest, I was bullied, like, and I thought, like, you know, sure, these are only country folks, do you know what I mean, and they're bullying me. And it all kind of started when I moved out to country, things started to change for me. I was just didn't care, like, and got into bad old circles, and yeah, and especially with not having brothers and sisters and that, like, you know. So
when you think back to both of your stories now, like, we can never change the past at this point, but what we can do maybe is have a conversation about how people in tough positions right now can be positively affected. Like,
yeah,
I mean, I'm not sure if this is something that you have off the top of your head, but how would you like to see a young version of Emma treated now by the powers that be, by the education system, by the social system in this country? Like, what could be done better to ensure that
looked after
a bit more?
Yeah, right. So I look at my daughter.
Yeah.
And she's 12 now, so she's going into secondary school next September, please God. And I look at her, and I don't want her to have the life that I had, or hang around with people that's going to drag her down, or, you know, get involved with different things, because that's what I did. You know, I was always easily led, and I'd do anything. Do you know what I mean? I didn't care what it was. And then it all fall back on me. I'm looking at my daughter now, and I want her to have the best life, and I'm going to give her the best life. You know, and I just say to her, she can come and talk to me about anything. Doesn't matter what it is. And, you know, getting that wee bond is going to be hard, but it's slowly getting there, gradually getting there with her. But I want her to have, you know, a good life. And as I say, you know, hang around the right people. She's a really good friend of circles now, but she still is easily, very, very easily led. And I've seen it. Seen it with my own eyes, like, you know, the way she carries on and things like that. She's just a replica of me, and I just don't want that life for her.
Okay.
I want her to have a good life. So she's a younger version of myself, like.
Scott, what about yourself? The younger version of Scott that's out there today, and like, what structures can be improved? What can be done to ensure that more care is out there for somebody who's in a precarious enough position in their late teens?
Yeah, or just like late teens, or as a kid, like as a young fella.
They are two separate things, right?
Yeah, because like I only found like all these feelings and things when I was a teenager from being a kid. Like,
yeah,
I think it comes from being a kid. Like, if you're a parent, like, I'm not speaking for a kid here, I'm speaking for a parent, you know. If you're a parent, try to do it for your kid, like, because it just, to be honest, it wasn't right, you know, having a not a stable home and then to a stable home, like, it's very mind-fogging, like, as a kid, you know, you're switching and then you're carrying behaviours you're doing all week, and then you're switching them off, and then you're meant to be this good kid to your dad, and then it's like, where do you stand? And this is how you grow up to be this person. Like, I'm a master manipulator. Like, I'm deadly, that's from being a young fella, you know, doing that and being a lawyer, having to lie to my dad, saying this isn't happening at home, my ma is alright, she's not doing that, and, you know, like, she's not spending the, what's that money called again, you'd pay
children's allowance,
and my dad come and drop children's allowance, my ma would be like, tell your dad I bought you that, and I'd be telling my dad, oh, she got me that, but she didn't. And yeah, look, I just find that, for me anyway, what like needs to be sorted, what should have been sorted, was parenting problems, to be honest, you know, because that's what kind of set me out to who I was then. I'm not going to say who I am today, because who I am today was paused when I started taking drugs, you know. That's what I always think of that. When I first started taking drugs, my life paused, because I was who I was meant to be until I took drugs.
Okay.
Do you know?
And have you pressed play again in the last six and a half months?
Yeah, I have pressed play. Yeah, I'm doing very well. You know, yeah. I'm 14 months clean. Like,
I'm doing,
and it's crazy. These thoughts don't even come into my brain anymore. It's scary. The thought of taking another drug is terrifying for me. It manipulates me into being someone I'm not.
What does that look like now, the last 14 months? What is the happy sort of progress that you're experiencing? Like, what gets you out of bed in the morning now, obviously, other than, you know, going to the World Cup and things like that last month?
What gets me up out of bed is the thought of sitting in bed. We have to be doing something. I cannot sit in that room all day, you know, because then your mind is gone. Your mind is like, right, I'm bored, what am I going to do? Like, don't get me wrong. Like, there is thoughts that come and then they go, and it's how you fucking, yeah, attack them thoughts of like, right, I'm not taking a drug today. Don't worry about tomorrow.
Yeah.
Just don't take a drug today. Like, you can't do a week's time thinking. Just worry about when you wake up, and then every hour as it comes. But the thing that gets me up today is myself, because I am buying myself. I feel like, I know I'm not buying myself in the world, but how do I describe it? I am stable to me and me only. So what I do is just for me, no one else. So when I'm up early in the morning, I'm getting up for me. When I'm cooking dinner just for me. It's just a very motivational thing for myself that you're doing it for no one but yourself, Scott. Treat yourself.
Yeah.
You know, give yourself a life that, even if it is living in town, like, you're still living. You have a roof over your head. You have a bed. You have a cooker. You have an air fryer. You have all these things that anyone would wish for out there.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm 20 and I'm just grateful for that. I have like keys off a door that I'm trusted for. You know? So, yeah, my get me up every day is me. So, yeah.
Emma, for yourself, having kids crystallizes while you get up out of bed every morning, I'm sure, as well. And it's great to hear that they're doing well. What else is motivating you, and what else is driving you on at the moment?
So I have to say, like, I'd have gratitude, like, you know, getting up, and I'm actually in phase two now in Cool Mind. So I do get up. I'm actually in the Dublin Simon at the minute.
Right.
So I'm staying there at the minute, and, you know, getting up and, like, to be honest, dressing my bed.
Yeah.
You know, and cleaning around, and, you know, getting myself ready, and, you know, because I wouldn't have, like, I would have been a big isolator, like, and thinking, oh, this is, you know, I'm not going to do this anymore, and my head would be all manic and all. And since I've gone into Ashley House, you know, you're up at a certain time. You know, my body clock is actually now, I'm awake at 5:30 every morning. I might get up out of the bed at that time, but I know that I have to, and I did text the kids, or I might ring them or something, and say to them, like, you know, good morning and that, and to be there laughing on the phone, and just to even see them now. But it's them. I'm doing it for myself, but I'm also doing it for my three babies, like,
yeah,
fighting for them, like, you know.
Half 5 is a great bio clock. That's a great bio clock.
I could fall back
people
to sleep.
Jealous of that now, listening into that.
I could fall back to sleep. It's on me this 4 weeks now since I started and stepped down, to be honest. 5:30, whatever's going on. But yeah, no, that's, I get up every morning, like, and I'm grateful for it, like.
Yeah.
Grateful.
Guys, I must say it's been an absolute privilege chatting to you both. Thank you so much for sharing your story, and hopefully we haven't overimposed ourselves too much into your lives, but thank you once again for sharing, and congrats again, particularly to the women's team and what you did in Oslo.
That's not fair.
The men's team need to give a better show next time.
I have to say, they had hard teams. Yeah, they did well.
I'm only messing. You have been listening to Scott O'Brien and Emma Brennan here in studio with us, folks. Thanks again, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.